Hello, and welcome to the Preview Spotlight Interviews on the Comic Page Podcast. My name is John Mayer.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be talking with creators about upcoming projects available in the current month's previews catalog. Hello everyone, and welcome to the November Previews Interviews episode for the Comic Book Page. This month I had a little bit less time than usual, and I only got one interview recorded, but it's a great one. I had the chance to talk to both the writer, Derek McCullough, and the artist, Colleen Duran, about the original graphic novel from Vertigo called Gone to Amerike. This is a 144-page hardcover original graphic novel that is a century-spanning exploration of the history of Irish emigres to New York City, and there is a mystical element to it, but I don't want to reveal too much because you'll learn that by listening to the interview with the two creators coming right up. But I will point out that this is advance solicited. It's not going to show up in stores until March, but it's on the November order form. So you want to make sure you go to your shop and ask them to order it now. And if you're a DCBS customer, you can get it for 50% off, which is a great deal. You'll be able, instead of the $25 cover price, get it for $12.50. Let's get into the interview. I'm happy to have the creative team for the new graphic novel from DC called Gone to Amerike. I've got writer Derek McCullough and artist Colleen Duran. Thank you for joining me, both of you.
Thanks.
Okay, Derek, let's talk about where you came up with the idea for the story and just kind of a high-level overview of what the story's about.
Sure. I grew up listening to Irish music, Irish folk music. My favorite group from the time I was 4 years old was the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem, and their songs about Ireland and about I always call it the classic Irish songs about getting drunk and dying. The big foundation of my childhood, and it's stuff that I've listened to my whole life. And I once had an idea about kind of stringing together a bunch of their songs about different bits of Irish folklore and history and making a big story out of them, and that idea was in the back of my head for a long time, and it's kind of, I think, a little piece of what turned out to be Gone to Amerike. As far as the overview, it's a story about Irish immigrants to America over a period of, how long is it, 140 years, actually. It takes place in three time periods, 1870, right at the very, very extreme tail end of what would be called the famine emigration period. It takes place in 1960, in the Greenwich Village folk scene that the Clancy Brothers were part of, although they came more out of Chicago. And then just a little bit in 2010. And you know, I'm obviously not going to go into too much detail about how the stories link together. You have to read the book to learn that. But the 1870 story is about a young woman who has come to America with her 3-year-old daughter. And they're waiting for her husband to join, and are on their own in a very, very bad place in the 5-point slum in New York. The 1960 period is about a singer who, he actually comes to America to be an actor and falls into the folk scene. And the 2010 period piece is about somebody learning about both of these stories.
Yeah. Very good. Now, at what point did you came up with the idea? At what point did you bring Colleen into the mix here for this graphic novel?
She was there at the beginning. We pitched it together to DC.
Oh, very good. Now, Colleen, why don't you talk a little bit about the design sense that you brought to it, you know, and maybe a little bit from question for both of you. We'll start with Colleen on just research or what you had to do, especially for the some of the more period stuff, 1870, 1960.
It took an awful lot of research. I spent months just studying for the book. I took a lot of time with my nose buried in the National Archives and went through literally thousands and thousands of images and have more than 1,000 images in my reference files for this book. Everything had to be authentic. I've always considered Hal Foster a model for how to approach drawing comics, and I want to make things as authentic as an experience for the reader as possible. Now, I'm not the draftsman Hal Foster is, maybe someday, but I certainly want to bring the same level of scholarship to the work that he did. And I hope I've done that. Now, I did have some advantages, particularly with the section that takes place in the 1870s. I live in a very, very rural area, a very isolated area in Appalachia, and a lot of things haven't changed very much out here. And when it came to finding tools or period knickknacks that one might have around the house, it actually wasn't that difficult. There are people that still live like that out here. We also have frontier festivals where people dress the part and bring out all of their things and bring out their skills. And I took, I don't know how many photos for my files. But naturally, I didn't end up using 90% of it. But the important thing is to be able to draw something as if you've actually seen it. And I've never seen 1870. No one really has. So I had to draw the pictures to give the reader the impression that they were looking at the work of someone who was there. That's how I approach everything I draw. I want people to believe they've seen an account of something that happened. And I hope I've achieved that in this book.
You did.
But you said you had actual photos from back then that you were looking at in the National Archives. So even if you weren't personally there.
Well, you got to understand that most of the photography from that time period was photographs taken by people in the upper classes. We're really not dealing with a whole lot of that. There was only one photographer who spent any time dealing with poverty, and that was Jacob Ruth. And his archives are not as extensive as I would like, but they sure do bring the point home. The photographs of the poor people in the slums of New York are heartbreaking. They're just ghastly. You can't believe how bad, well, maybe you can't believe how bad it was. It's just awful. It just tears you up to look at these photos of these children in rags walking around in mud. It's just god-awful. And these poor immigrants in crowded in tumble-down buildings and sleeping on planks of wood. Just the saddest stuff you ever saw. And you think, you know, those are your parents, those are your grandparents, those are your great-grandparents, that's your family living that life. It's just awful. You think what they went through and to get us where we are today, God, you can't believe that anybody survived such a miserable life. But they did. And,
but then that gives us the uplifting part, right? Because these people, the strength, the character that you had to have, and the perseverance to actually make it through that kind of an environment, your
character,
children.
Character is one thing, but, some of these people weren't very nice. You can say strength of character, but it was more like survival of the fittest. Some of the people were very, very good, and some of the people were not so good, and we do address that in the book. Strong people survived, not necessarily good ones.
Now, one thing that I think a lot of people might be familiar with, I'll ask the question, and I can see how much you guys base it on this. But I know for myself, when I hear the 5-point slum, I think back to that movie, The Gangs of New York, you know, with Leonardo DiCaprio and, you know, those folks in it. And was there any amount of using that as a template, or did you kind of like not want to get yourself involved in like that Hollywood interpretation of the period?
Well, I did read the book that Gangs in New York was based on, which is, you know, kind of good news, bad news. I mean, it's a very entertaining book, but its connection to reality is a little tenuous. I read another book. I'm blanking a lot. It's called either 5 Points or the 5 Points. I forget. Scanning my bookshelf here to see if I can I can see it and tell you the title of it. But it's a more scholarly, authoritative history of the area, and specifically debunks a lot of stuff that's in the Gangs in New York. I think Colleen, you did use the movie a little bit visually, didn't you?
A little bit. The problem is that, first of all, Gangs in New York takes place before.
Yeah, it takes place a lot earlier, yeah.
It takes place a lot earlier, and after the war, things had begun to change quite a bit, and I think Gangs in New York ends right around the end of the Civil War, and the, you know, Grande Amérique is some years later, but Gangs in New York actually starts much, much earlier, and of course they really take it over the top with the, you know, piled up skulls and everything in the
yeah,
lower echelons of some of the horrible buildings. And, you know, it was bad enough, but I don't remember actually finding any evidence that stuff like that happened. It was the most interesting thing about the film for me visually, which, by the way, I really love the film, and I wish there was more of this in the movie, was the contrast between the slums and the upper class area. It's hard to believe it's the same planet. You know, when you go to New York, you walk around New York, and you know, there's a certain aesthetic to the whole city in Manhattan. You walk around, and you never feel like you're in a different country. But back then, you really did. You could go from one neighborhood to the next and not even believe you're on the same planet. And it's hard to believe how undeveloped Manhattan was, how it was swampland.
Oh yeah.
And yeah.
You know, the building, the Dakotas, the place where John Lennon lived when he died, it was the building in Rosemary's Baby. That it was, the reason it was called the Dakota was that it was perceived as being out in the middle of nowhere when it was built. There, it was this big building in this middle of empty, desolate land in Manhattan, which you don't think of there being nowadays any empty, desolate land in Manhattan, but that's what that was back then. That's all.
Oh, interesting. I mean, it's like, I don't know, I know very little about that period, so it's fascinating that you both are exploring it now. Is this a straight historical fiction story, or is there some, without going into spoilers, or is there some bit of a, you know, fantastical element to it?
This is, well, I'll say it's a completely
fictional
story. yeah. There are one or two historical characters that pop up in it in little cameos doing things.
More like 15 or 20, because I had to look them up.
Were there that many?
There were a lot. There were a lot of little cameos. Sometimes just like one or two panels, but they're all.
Yeah, it's been a while since I wrote the thing, so I forget. But yeah, none of them are terribly important to the plot, but they're just there for flavor and color, you know. But yeah, there is a fantastical vein in it. I think I had a phrase of mine described it at Comic-Con this summer, that it's a crime story, and it's got a crime story and a ghost story and a couple, and they're all wrapped up together. That's what the book is. Unless I forgot some part of it there.
Now, how long did it take you working on this, Colleen? It's a long book.
It's a long book. It will have been almost 3 years.
Wow.
When did I start, Derek? Was it like February 2008? And I'll be finished in about a week and a half. And it's of course not the only thing I've done in that time. I think there was a 6 month period where I barely touched it. But
she took a little break to do a whole other book.
Yeah, I did a whole other book in that time. But the art style that we chose to use for Grande Mercier is so difficult and detail intensive and rendering intensive that it was, you know, when we kind of settled on it, I have to confess I groaned a little bit knowing that it was going to be a lot more difficult a project, because my original sample was drawn in a much more modern style with heavy blacks and a looser line. And then I turned in some work with these very, very rendered sort of Harper's Bazaar time period line work, which nobody does because it's very time consuming.
Looks great though.
Thanks, but that is the look we chose to go with for the book, and I'm very happy we did. But it is just not something you can do on a monthly basis. You know, virtually every page took 2 days or more.
Wow.
And some of them took a lot longer than that. And a couple of them were so difficult and complex, I'd work on them for an hour a day over a period of months and just keep setting them aside, you know, because otherwise you'd just be gnawing off your leg. So we just happened to pick the most difficult and labor-intensive kind of style to do the book there is, and I'm not complaining and I'm not sorry about it. I'm just emphasizing that, you know, there's a reason why stuff like this doesn't come out very often.
Right. I mean, but you picked it because it was the style that seemed to best convey the story.
Sure, it's right for the book. I think the first thought was to go with an orbiter kind of art style, which is, you know, very heavy on blacks and very simple rendering. And then I did a couple of panels with this style, and Karen Berger, our editor, just went, no, do that. And it was like, oh, ouch, because you could spend quite a good deal of time on one square inch. And a lot of the places in the book where it looks like it's a solid black, if you look carefully, it's not. It's all hatching. And it's all done with a pen point that's as small as the point of a pin. And every line is built up with this tiny little pen point. And it's not the way most people draw comics. In fact, I think my inking style has come more out of illustrators like Ben Shawn than most comic illustration. In fact, I think most comic book people tell you never to draw like this. You know, it's just not cartooning and whatever. But I really don't care. I think it works for this book, and I'm happy with the way it looks.
I'm getting more and more excited about getting the book in December or January. I guess it's coming.
No, it's not. It's coming out in March.
I'm looking at the solicit here.
Yeah.
It's advanced.
It's in the first quarterly catalog.
Oh, is it in previews?
Yeah, it's in previews. It's in the November previews. So that's when, you know, we want to drive people to the stores to get this one on the radar of their shop owners, because this is when it's being ordered.
Yeah. Yeah. What is the order number anyway?
I don't have the order number in front of me. I don't have it in front of me because I'm looking at the online solicit. The previous catalog is not out yet.
Oh, wow. I haven't seen that. That's awesome.
But it'll be in the November's previews catalog. And, you know, that's, again, I like to do these talks with the creators when it's out there for the shops to order, because people can listen to this and they can say, wow, you know, I really want to read that. And they got to go pester their store. You know, it's like, hey, order this.
So yeah, I have no idea how much coverage they're going to give it. I know that they're very hopeful for this book, not just in the comics market, but outside it. I know that they're very much into pushing this to people who don't read comics. I would recommend it to anyone who doesn't read a comic book, honestly, you know, she said modestly. It's a book. I mean, it's a novel. It, you know, there's Nothing in it I'd be sorry to give to somebody who's never picked up a comic graphic novel in their life.
I think, and we need more stuff like that. Frankly, it's just, getting this into bookstores will be great. I'm sure it will be. You know, DC does a good job of that, getting things covered like that. Now,
well, if it doesn't move, it won't be for lack of trying, because I don't I think we all just gave this one everything. I mean, every detail, we were crazy about it. We would, every tiny little thing.
There are a couple funny stories about that. My favorite one recently was, there was one page where I described, in the panel description, I said there was a sea snake poking through the eye socket of a skull, and Colleen, of course, being very diligent, didn't want to just draw any sea snake. She had to know which is the right sea snake, so she went and researched what sea snakes are native to the North Atlantic, and found, of course, that there aren't any sea snakes in the North Atlantic. And they ended up saying, okay, make it seaweed.
Well, remember there was a drink that you wanted somebody to order, and then Joan Hilty, who was the editor at the time,
looked it up
and said that drink did not yet exist. It wasn't invented for X number of years, so we had to change that. But there were all kinds of little details, that we had to make sure were correct.
All right, we had had this very protracted discussion over which hand a guy would be holding a fork in.
Yeah.
Because
in Europe, people eat with the other hand. So there was this drawing out discussion of, well, they're immigrants. Would they be using American manners, or would they still be using European manners? And if they're trying to pass as Americans, would they be trying to be more American than Americans? And we put a lot of thought into this sort of thing, and other little things like what side are the buttons on? Because we know that women have their buttons on one side of their clothes and men have their buttons on the other side of their clothes. But back in the day, when people had servants, buttons on women's clothes for the upper class would be on the other side of their clothes, so that their servants could button with their right hand. So I know that this is the kind of wacky detail that means to me a great deal. I'm sure most of the readers won't even notice.
Yeah.
But
it's fascinating, though, because, you know, there's so many comic books that, you know, you see go out and there's not even apparently rudimentary attention to, laws of physics, anatomy, whether something could actually physically exist in that pose, or, I was looking at one recently, where it's just like a street was drawn that didn't even look like it was wide enough for two cars to pass one another in opposing directions. And it's just, when somebody does put the attention into the craft, that, I mean, it might not be something that jumps off the page at the reader, but I got to believe that all of that builds up together to give it realism.
Yeah, it all goes towards selling the story, to making it a reality you can live in, you can believe in,
In defense of my fellow creators, this is not something you can do on a monthly. And DC was extremely indulgent with me every time. Well, now, first of all, they put the book back a year because of, the shakeups at Vertigo, and they said, we'd like to push this into another date, and you can go do something else for a while, which is why I had time to go do another graphic novel, Manga Man, for Houghton Mifflin. But, I got to tell you, the plight of the monthly artist is not a happy one. They have brutal hours. They don't have time to put into a project the kind of work and effort that we've put into it. And whenever, this ass-dragging artist, me, has asked for an extension, they've been extremely generous. They have rolled out the red carpet for me on this whole project. I am overwhelmed by how well we have been treated and what wonderful support we've gotten on this book. We could not have done it as a monthly, not to this degree. And I actually don't even need to have the finished book in for weeks, but I'm trying to finish it as quickly as possible because I'm leaving the country. But the solid backing that we've got from DC has been extraordinary. There is no way on my own time and on my own dime, I could have done this book because I would have starved to death. You don't get 5 to 7 days to do a double page spread and still be able to eat. You know, you need a publisher backing you up and willing to wait that long to give you the time that you need to do that level of work. And, you know, I realize there are some monthly artists who are better than others and who have some draftsmanship problems, but the fact of the matter is that's a grueling, grueling way to live. And not a whole lot of art is being produced a page a day to this degree. I mean, there's a reason why cartoony artists work faster. Hal Foster only did one page of Prince Valiant a week, and it shows.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of Prince Valiant myself, so when I heard at the beginning of the interview you saying that, I didn't realize that Hal Foster was such a model or hero of yours, but, you know, I love looking at those big, I guess recently Fantagraphics, I think, is putting out those hardcover editions of the old Prince Valiant stuff.
Yeah, I already have all the softcover editions. I've been a huge Prince Valiant fan. I mean, it was the first comic book, first comic, really, I became interested in. And they were the first graphic novels I ever bought. A lot of people don't realize, but back in the 1970s, there were several publishers that were collecting them. And you could buy them through Scholastic. And that's how I got my first Prince Valiant books. They would actually usually just take panels from them and add extensive captions. But I would clip it out of the Sunday paper every day and save them. And, of course, by then it wasn't Hal Foster anymore. It was John Cullen Murphy. But that, to me, has always been where I wanted to go with my work. And, of course, almost everybody else is going in the complete opposite direction to make everything very immediate and cartoony. And I remember having a rather bitter feud with Scott McCloud over whether or not Prince Valiant was actually cartoony. And I just happen to think it is. I just think it's on the illustrative end of cartooning. But that's actually what I prefer. There are other artists who are wonderful at doing the great broad brushstrokes and beautiful, exciting and dynamic body language. And you know, you think of somebody like Jeff Smith, and he's just fantastic. But to me, the way to go has always been Hal Foster way. And it's technically incredibly difficult because, you know, part of his appeal was his mastery of draftsmanship. And you can probably count on your fingers the number of people who can pull that off. You know, like, holy cow. And you know, you think, wow, who can draw that well and who was that innovative as a storyteller and who was that innovative in terms of page design and layout. A lot of the things we take for granted now, he created.
And just having the opportunity to put the time in that it takes to do something like
that. And of course his originals were huge. I mean, they were, I don't know if you've ever seen any of them, but they were like the equivalent of like 2.5 comic pages. They were really, really large. And I don't think people realize that either. His brushstrokes were actually kind of broad. Well, broad compared to what I'm doing, that is, when I'm inking with a pinpoint. But he was, and the originals are just huge. They're like fine art paintings. They're big, 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 big. And they're worth every penny. If I ever get filthy rich, one of them puppies is going on my wall.
Let me ask another question about working together on this project. Now, you, Derek, you mentioned, you know, one of your page and panel descriptions with the sea snake turning into seaweed and like that. How much, so it seems like you did full script, but as far as the breaking down the story into chapters and panels or pages and panels and stuff, where was the, how much give and take there was there with Colleen on that, on the design of your story into the physical art medium?
I always write full scripts broken down into pages and panels. I always turn it into the artist with the caveat that they can, for the most part, ignore anything I say about how I describe describe the scene. If they've got a better idea, I'm open to it. I used to give a lot more leeway than I feel like I do now in terms of inviting them to split out or combine panels if they feel like I'm kind of stuck on my own sense of the storytelling rhythm now at this point. If somebody wants to split or combine a panel on a page, it's okay. The thing I'm most uptight about is changing where a page breaks. That's just such a huge rhythm and storytelling element in comics that I really like to keep control of that. But I did give the script to Colleen, and did, I'm pretty sure early on I said, you know, ignore what you want to ignore, but she stuck to the script almost exactly. Yeah, I think there were a couple of instances where you split a panel or switched a perspective or something. I wouldn't have minded if you'd done more. I mean, I know on Stagger Lee, the book I did with Shepard Hendricks, I know there were a lot of instances where I described scenes opening with an interior shot, and he changed it. With an interior shot, and he changed it to an exterior establishing shot, or vice versa. And that's as long as it works for the scene, which it always does. I'm fine with it. Colleen really stuck to the script.
I don't like to mess around with the writer's intent. The only time I change something is if I really think it's a better angle for a particular shot, but like you said, I only did that, you know, maybe three panels out of hundreds.
Yeah, I think the biggest instance was there was one of the there are three double page scripts in the book, or double page scripts, I say double page spreads in the book. You'll just have to see them to believe them. But one of them, I described a really kind of wacky angle thing on it that worked in my head, but I just couldn't quite get it across.
It required movement, it just didn't work. And I probably spent more time trying to lay out that scene than anything. We finally came up with something that satisfied everyone. But what he was actually asking for was a swooping shot that I just couldn't make it work. I just didn't think it did work without movement. And it's something that I've run into a few times when working with people who are screenwriters. They forget that the picture doesn't move. We can give the illusion of movement, but it's only an illusion. So because of the constraints of the actual space we're working in, because some of these scenes take place in real locations, I have to play fast and loose with perspective, and I have to, you know, I have to fake it a little bit because what he asked for doesn't actually fit in the picture. So the end result looks real because I can figure out how to fudge the perspective in a convincing way, even though it's not real. You think what you looked at is actually what happens when you see that location, because it's convincing, but it's not what happens. I had to shrink things and fake the perspective. If you carefully sit down there with a ruler and try to work out the perspective, you will find out it's not true. And that's a great thing about being a cartoonist is we're not photographers. We're not married to fidelity. We can play fast and loose with reality a little bit. So
it just hit me. I haven't seen that page. Now I'm really curious.
Oh, you've seen this page. You just don't even know it. The last double page spread? Yeah, that's probably the last thing I'm going to finish. But
I haven't seen it yet.
You haven't seen that yet. But the middle double page spread, I did amazing things with his perspective.
Okay. Yeah, I thought you were talking
totally
about the last
fake,
one.
Dude. No, it's totally fake.
Yeah,
and,
okay.
The last one is also the far left panel. The perspective is is fanciful. Because I needed to get the building that I'm drawing is actually quite wider than will fit in the shot, so I made it longer and thinner, and you know, it's totally fake. But the only thing that I did do, and I did it consistently through the book, was I got rid of panel borders. There are a lot of freeform page designs throughout the book, and I tended to do that where I thought, it's hard to describe what I intend when I do this. I like to do it for sequences that are out of time or meant to convey some kind of sensation, or I'm trying to convey mood more than I'm trying to convey moment. So there are many places in the book where I just didn't use any panel borders at all. So it is panel one, panel two, panel three, panel four, but the images are floating around the page as opposed to having panel borders. So
a montage effect.
A montage effect, more than one panel, two panel, three panel, four panel. And I know some people hate that sort of thing. They'll probably give me a hard time.
It looks beautiful.
Well, thank you. I have very strong ideas about when that is right to do and when it's not right to do. And some people think you shouldn't do it at all, but I happen to like the effect, and I think it works within the context of the story. In some places, the storytelling is very traditional and very moment by moment by moment by moment, and in other places, it isn't. And I hope that I've been wise with my choices and that they serve the story in a new
way. You know, someday when we have like a lot of hours, I'd like to sit down with you and kind of find out why'd you go this way here and not there. what the choices were exactly. I'm really very curious about that.
Yeah, I've got a running debate in my head with a lot of other artists about the composition of pages, and a lot of them are so focused on traditional composition, you know, and then there's of course the Z form composition, which gets you going from the left side of the page to the right, then down, then over. But I happen to believe also in composing a page that focuses on a character's face and their emotional content. So you'll see a number of pages where somebody's face and what they're thinking dominates the page, and everything else on that page surrounds that moment. And it serves that moment more than anything else. And I'm sure that there are people who disagree with this choice, but we don't care about them.
Yeah, no, that's right for the book. You know what you were saying, Colleen, about artists, about a comic artist who's not a photographer and doesn't, you know, and has a certain sense of freedom because of that. It just reminded me of a conversation I had a long time ago with a historian when I was working on Stagger Lee. I had been using this guy as a kind of informal consultant on some of the stuff that I was doing, and he would be, I don't know, who would hit on something that wasn't quite historically accurate. He would be very stymied about what to do about it. And I would say, well, you know, that's the advantage I have as a writer of fiction. You know, you're a historian, you have to stick with what actually happened. I can make things up if I have to. It's very
free. I just don't want to do anything that breaks the proscenium.
Yeah.
I don't want to do anything that reminds you that it's a story. When I draw something like this, my intent is to give people the impression that they're experiencing a memory, and that I've drawn all of this because it's something that I remembered that happened. And
right.
I think that's far more real than, you know, the photography school of comics, which always breaks me out because my thought is, you know, oh, you know, here are all the people I know that he got to pose for him, and everything looks very light-boxed and blah, 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 blah. And I'm very impressed by the skill and the beauty of the hyperrealism, but it often breaks the proscenium for me. I know that sounds strange because it should be more real, but in some ways it's less real. Maybe it would be more real if I weren't an artist and didn't know the people involved. and didn't know what was being done. So I try to stay away from that. I always want things to have a certain dreamlike quality to them or a memory quality to them where you feel like the person who drew it was actually there. It's quite, I just lost my train of thought, but,
I don't know if you ever heard me say this one, but I made up a little motto for myself, actually a little promise to the reader as a writer of historical fiction, which is, I'll make stuff up all the time, but I'll never lie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
I think we're at a roll.
I think there's a great element. I mean, hearing you two talk about this, I mean, there's very clearly a tremendous amount of passion for the storytelling that went into the creating this graphic novel, as well as, within the context of it's a fictional story, for the fictional realism, let's say, of the story, so that it feels like it's, you know, that you can feel as a reader like you're being carried away into this story, and it's really going to be something that's not breaking that suspension of disbelief, because there's just certain things that can take you out of the story in many cases, whether those are story writing elements or art elements in some cases. It sounds like you've done a lot of your homework and due diligence to make sure that we're not going to have any of those. So I'm really looking forward to reading this. I want to remind the listeners again, this is in your November previews catalog. It'll be advanced solicited because it won't be coming out until March. But, you know, now is the time to express your interest to your comic shop owners so that they'll start thinking about getting orders in for those books. Make sure they're not just on, you know, in your pull box, but, you know, if enough people express an interest in it, then hopefully they'll have some copies for the rack. And then DC will be doing the work that needs to be done to get this out into Barnes & Noble and, Hastings and other bookstores so that the general population can enjoy this story. I want to thank you both for taking the time with me. If you want to read more of Derek's work, I will recommend, he's mentioned it a couple of times, Stagger Lee was a fabulous graphic novel, as well as his recent work for Image Pug. And Colleen, I personally think of you most for your phenomenal distant soil that is out there, and I am a huge fan of that that work, as well as you've done issues here and there of a lot of other comics that I've enjoyed over the years. You did a couple issues of Sandman, if I'm not mistaken, as well as I remember you did some work on Power Pack and lots of other places. You were mentioning you took the 6-month break and you did a book for Houghton Mifflin.
Mm-hmm.
What was that one called again?
It's called Manga Man. It's a young adult graphic novel. It's about a manga character who falls through a rift in reality and ends up in the real world. And it's written by Barry Liga, who is a very popular young adult novelist. He's written some terrific books like The Adventures of Fanboy and Goth Girl. And he is really sharp. I love this guy's work, and I was so glad when he called me up. And what's funny is you just never know in comic fandom how things will work out. We were both in an apazine back in the 1980s when we were young. And we were big fans of the Teen Titans, and he remembered me from back then. And he says, I've always wanted to work with you. Will you do my graphic novel? So we were fan kids in Titan Talk. And, you know, 20-some-odd years later, we end up working together. How funny is that?
That's great. And I know a lot of our listeners have, kids who fall into that young adult category. So that would be something for them to keep their eyes out for. Manga Man.
Yeah, it'll be out in about, I think it's going to be out in about 2 weeks.
So actually, it'll probably be out right around the time people are listening to this interview.
That'd be groovy.
Yeah.
Very good.
So I just said groom.
Go to the store, get your copy of Manga Man, and tell them to order Gone to America while you're there.
That's right. That would be awesome. I wish I was more lively, but I'm not sleeping much because I'm finishing Gone to America. Trying to finish it over the next couple of weeks so I can move on with my life.
So it should be done again. By the time people listen to this, it should
it
be
probably
done.
Will. It probably will. It's, you know, it's all going to depend on this evil last double-page spread, which is, you know, taking over my life. It fortunately, it's getting easier as you go because there's less and less reference to plow through. Every page, I've actually started getting rid of some of the documents that I don't need anymore because they're just cluttering up the office. But it's just getting so exciting because I don't have to look things up every time I draw them now. Now that I'm, you know, almost done.
Well, thank you both so much for taking the time with me. And again, seems like a long time. You got me all excited now. I have to wait 5 months to get this book. But I will be reading it when it comes out. And it sounds like it'll be definitely worth the wait. And I encourage everyone, again, go out, prompt your stores, get it on your pre-order list. That way, when it does come out, it'll just show up in your pull box.
Thank you so much for having us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you both.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.